All right. Everyone, so we're ready to get started. Thank you so much for bearing with us as we got everybody in here after that awesome keynote. I'm Aubrey Blanche. I'm Atlassian's Global Head of Diversity and Inclusion. And we have a couple of fabulous panelists. I'm going to let them introduce themselves in a few minutes. But I wanted to say a little bit about the topic of the panel before we dive into questions. So I was super excited to be here today, especially at a women's conference, because one of my personal passions is thinking about diversity and equity in an intersectional way. So if you don't like that $17 word, all it means is that people have layers. And so thinking about not just someone's gender identity, but also the other identities that interact with that is really important in understanding our experiences. And everyone kind of just like, yeah, that makes sense. I didn't need a big word for that. So this is really a passion of mine, talking about race. And our panelists are amazing. We've all talked before. And you'll hear both some personal stories and some sort of professional things from different fields, different companies that we're in. But the reason that this is so important is because while we have made absolutely amazing progress in some areas of gender equality, I think it's really important to also get real about where we are. So currently, there is one black woman, one Asian woman, and zero Latina women that are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, right? White women, a little more, but we're talking about 4.4% of the Fortune 500. And when you look at levels below that, the numbers don't get much better. So talking about these things is the first way that we sort of start making progress and the way that we can understand the way that race interacts with all of the other identities that we have and how we get to real equity in the workplace and in business more generally. So my favorite question, you're going to get to hear all of my panelists. They'll introduce themselves. And then I would love if you could talk about when did you become aware of your racial identity? And what is it? Has it meant for you, do you think, in your career? So.
Okay. So I'm Brian Miller, Vice President of Learning and Development and Inclusion. I oversee basically all of executive development down the front line, employees, including onboarding, mentoring, coaching, executive coaching, and of course, also inclusion and diversity. I've been with Gilead, it'll be 7 years in April, so that's a fairly long time for our company, which average tenure is about 3 years for about 50% of the population. So that's a little bit about me. Now, the question regarding when I was first aware. So it's interesting, I don't think I was ever not aware of sort of my race and my ethnicity. Since third grade, I've been in private schools, usually all white. My high school, believe it or not, is a Catholic all-boy high school. There was only five blacks in my, actually, freshman year, and only three of us made it to graduation. So I've never not been aware. How it's affected me is I tell a story typically to majority of the executives just this past year about the idea of being good enough. And that typically is something I've always struggled with, is are you good enough? Do you have to do a little bit more? For me, that's the way I grew up. So single mom, you push hard, you embrace hard work, and you always look to see if you can get a little better. What it tends to do from a leadership perspective, in my point of view, it tends to hamper me in the idea that I never feel that I've accomplished something. I'm always thinking I could have done a little bit better. My team will know that about me. I tend to set the bar very high, and I tend to always push a little bit harder. So that's how it's pretty much affected me.
Yeah, I'm Marjane Moore Roberts. I am the Global Head of Inclusive Diversity for Yahoo. I've been in the role for about 10 months now, 9 months. I took it in April of last year. I transitioned out of a sales role I was in for 4.5 years there and decided to take on this new role when I was laid off from the sales job. So it's a new venture for me professionally, but it is not new for me in terms of my life. I have always been aware of race. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio in the 70s. I went to public high schools. My family, my mother and father were working class, so they both worked and had jobs. So we lived, and I wouldn't call it middle class by any means, but certainly had two parents who worked. So we grew up in a house that they bought, and we were surrounded by other families who owned homes. The interesting thing for us is that we came into our neighborhood right before the white flight. So there was white flight to the suburbs, and there were probably about 5 or 6 families, I remember, who were on their, like, we were moving in, they were, like, moving out. And everyone around us was, except for one family, Kelly and Mindy Thomas, who used to have sleepovers, were all black. And so I became aware, I'm the 3rd of 4 children, and my older siblings were absolutely aware because they had, you know, been in school longer, and I would hear things in and out. But in one of our sleepovers with Kelly and Mindy, I remember at first my older sister was having a slumber party, and they could come, but they couldn't spend the night. So we literally lived like 3 houses down. It was like 2 houses between ours. And they could, you know, we played together all the time, and they would come over and they would come to the party, and then before, you know, bedtime they had to go home. And then I heard her older brother would come and get her, come and get them, you know, occasionally. And this at my sister's slumber party, he said, "You cannot, you know, you don't sleep over a nigger's house." And we were like, you know, what? Y'all just ate our cake, you know. So I was aware. I mean, I must have been, my sisters are 3 and 4 years old, so I was, five, you know, 4 or 5, somewhere in there. And so I was always there, but because my, you know, you also knew, you know, in the 70s and in my life and my environment that, you know, you are black, and certain people think these things of you. You know that, and you keep going. And so we, you know, we kept going, and things kept changing around us, but it's always been there. And over time, the last thing I'll say is that it was constantly affirmed after that, right? So I went to a new school, it was affirmed. You know, I got into the alternative middle school, it was affirmed. When I became National Honor Society, it was affirmed. And then when I went to college, which was about 2,500 students, 32 of them were black. I was one of those 32. I really knew. Again, reaffirmed. So it never goes away. Something's always been there.
Hi, I'm Marissa Song. I work at Gilead. I'm Associate General Counsel of Corporate Legal. I also co-founded our first employee resource group at Gilead. It launched in 2016, and now we have 3 employee resource groups. I, like Brian Marginet, have been aware of my race since, I don't know, forever, in utero probably. Mm-hmm. It's something that I'm aware of every second of the day. It's something you can't shake. It's just so a part of your identity. I just remember, you know, the earliest memories of school was being called a chink, going to college, being called a chink, working in a law firm in downtown LA, wearing, you know, we had to wear suits then, still being called a chink. I mean, always being called a chink. I mean, even up here in the Bay Area. So it's something you just, you know, it catches you by surprise. You've never, I don't know, get over it. And it's just, I feel like it does carry to the workplace. I think by the Asian culture is such that you respect, you know, elders, you don't question authority. And that was totally fine and easy at the law firm because, you know, you work for, you know, white older men and you just did what they asked you to do. And that was super easy. But then when I worked at Gilead, transitioned in-house, it was first company job, and it's not okay to be quiet at meetings. It's not okay to defer to authority all the time, and you have to participate if you're in a meeting. So it was getting, you know, comfortable with myself, confidence. We've heard a lot about that today, and just getting, you know, knowing when to voice your opinion and when not to. And sometimes I feel like I'm not a very passive person. I'm pretty opinionated and direct, but the image I project is this, like, you know, passive Asian female at work. Always. I've gotten feedback from that. And it always surprises me because even if I'm not thinking I'm giving that image, it does come out. And it's just, I think it's cultural. It's like my upbringing, and it's just hard. It's hard to overcome.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a really, like, fraught relationship with my own racial identity, because, surprise, I'm Mexican, and I probably don't, like, at least half of you are like, you don't look Mexican, which it's not true, but so when I was a child, I was adopted by a white family. As you can imagine, I match. That was a joke. It's okay. I can laugh. But I became aware of my racial identity in two ways, and that I experienced white privilege in reverse. So Heritage Day, second grade, in the cafeteria, we all have to color our flags. And I was adopted by white people who are incredibly racially affirming. Like, you're Mexican, and that's great, and we're proud of you, and we're going to celebrate it, and you're going to get the Josefina doll, right? If anyone got American Girl dolls, but I was like, Samantha, she's a brunette. I want to be the Mexican one, even though I didn't look anything like that little doll. And so I was like, I'm Mexican, yay. And then Heritage Day came. And all the kids had, like, their flags of, like, France and Ireland. It was like me and the kid adopted from Korea over in the corner. And it was that moment, and it still sits in my stomach. I was like, oh, being Mexican is different. But I didn't quite get that it was bad. And then throughout the rest of my childhood, people would say things like, oh, well, you sharpen the pencils. Well, Mexicans do the service jobs. Or, like, people called me Aubrey-to, right? My name's Aubrey. It's a really bad pun. And it wasn't done in a malicious way, but I literally just thought it was normal. I was not traumatized by this. I didn't even think of it as bullying. I was just like, oh, that's how Mexican people are treated. Okay. And then I went to college, and nobody knew I was Mexican. And suddenly, no one said things like that to me. I was like, whoa. And it's been really hard for me to understand how to be part of a community that I don't physically represent. Like, I come out as Mexican all the time, right? Because, like, Latina women, it's like, got to be role models, so I'm just going to yell that I'm Latina so someone figures it out. But it was crazy to me, because the things that I experienced as a white-looking person, like the amount of racism that I've heard casually said in front of me, and I'm like, those are my people. And everyone's, like, mortified. I'm like, but why did you say that? So it's really interesting. I see myself as a lot of times as, like, I have to be the ambassador to my community, because I'm, like, not scary when I walk in the room. Like, I don't make other people feel like I am other. And so I can be the gateway for other people. But, Marjane, I know you were talking about building bridges, and that's kind of how I feel. Like, I'm this bridge between groups, because I kind of live in the middle. And you talk about building bridges around talking about race and about inclusion. Tell me a little bit about that and how you've approached it at Yahoo.
Yeah, so two things I want to say first. One of them is, one of my big learnings about race this year came when I read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me. And one of the things he talks about is how we conceptualize race as color, as group. And, you know, one of the things when I was setting up the Office of Inclusive Diversity, my team and I was going back and forth with our comms team. They were like, why do you keep making all the races capital? Why do you keep putting big B black and big W white? And I was like, because it's proper. And one of the big things out of that book that he talked about is, you know, race in and of itself is a social construct. And we have associated it with color for a long time, but it's not about color. It's about a station in life. It's about you sharpen the pencils. And when you were telling that story, that's what it reminded me of. And so because we built the construct, we have the ability to deconstruct that construct. And so that's one of the things I'm always aware of when I'm talking about race. And so this year, lots of things happened. Like, I took this job, you know, I did all of this stuff in college, and I was like, I'm gonna do diversity in college and fix it so I don't have to go do it again in 20 years when I'm working. I'm done with diversity, you know. I was like, you could not have told me I would be in a role as the head of diversity anywhere after going through Otterbein College in Westerville, Ohio in the early 90s. I just was not, we were done because we had done diversity. So I spent a lot of time before I took the role thinking about how are we still talking about this and why is this still an issue? And, you know, throughout that time I read the book, and I was also listening a lot to J.D. Lance, who wrote the book, I'm not going to remember the name of it, but the Hillbilly Elegy. And I was trying to, like, I was like, why? That's my question when I do this. Why are we still talking about race? You know, this is still a topic. And so then after that, the election happened. And the day after it was announced that Trump won, there's a line out my desk. Can you meet me in the conference room? You know, people were distraught. I was distraught. I was very upset, and everyone I know, it was a combination of things. And they're like, "What are you gonna do? You're the head of diversity. Do something." Like, I'm going to reverse the election. You know, and what I had to really come to terms with is how do we talk? So one of the first things I said, everybody's not sad. Let's just embrace that and sit with that. And then that was a moment, that was a sobering moment for many people, because it was that same thing of, I feel this, so everyone else must also feel this. But it really was not the case. And one of the first things that I had to get my head around when I knew I was gonna talk to people and I was gonna be asked, is that everyone is not disappointed. There are people celebrating today. And why is that? And when people would come to me and they wanted comfort, like, you know, crying, grown men, you know, I'd lie if I say, I wasn't on the verge of tears. And I said, what am I going to say to people? And what occurred to me through all of that, this is a very long story, is that if we take a look, it's very divided sides of this debate, argument, point of view, where's the commonality? If we took this column and made that column, what would we find? And you talk to group A and they'd say, I'm afraid of X. You talk to group B, they say, I'm afraid of X. And there was always a thread of fear among both groups. And so you look at the list, you put the same things in the middle, and there's your commonality. And all of a sudden you have fear from both sides. Well, I'm afraid I'm not gonna get what's mine. Well, I'm afraid you're trying to take what's mine. And fear in the middle of that, certainly I have something I can relate to. Suddenly, I have the woman who is a good person, who has been a good person all of her life, who's saying, but I just can't deal with another refugee in my neighborhood. I just need a break. And she's seriously crying and seriously in pain about that. And then I also know the other side of that story for someone who is like, I just cannot go into another job interview and be turned away because of the way I look. And all of these realities are valid on their own, independent of the other, yet they both exist in the same place. And so I just started talking to people and I started thinking, like, where's our commonality? Where can we come together? And we started looking at, you know, what do you feel? Why are you afraid? And trying to get some people to be able to relate to that. And then on the other side of that, what I noticed is people are really scared to have this talk. They're scared. I would ask them about diversity. They say, can I say black? Am I supposed to say African American? Am I allowed to say girl? Can I call you sweetheart? There was just all this confusion about what was and wasn't okay. And out of that, the other one is, I said, well, if you didn't talk to me about my race, what else would you talk to me about? Would you talk to me about being from the Midwest? Would you talk to me about being in sales? Would you talk to me about being a thespian? Like, what else could we talk about if the topic was not race? And so through that, people started, I think what I saw is people started to get a little bit less absorbed with their own point of view and start trying to think about the other point of view. And through that, there's an opportunity for a conversation. It's not fixed, but at least we can have the conversation. At least we can ask and try and answer the question. And that may be a bridge for us to move forward.
That's awesome. And Marissa, so a lot of us up here work professionally, and we have diversity or inclusion in our job titles. But you're in a little bit of a different position, but you certainly sort of championed inclusion and diversity at Gilead. Tell me a little bit about your, I call it volunteer work there, and sort of what inspired you to create the first ERGs at Gilead.
Well, Gilead is we thought it was always a very inclusive group. I don't know if many of you know about Gilead. We are primarily known for our HIV meds and HCV cure. So we have a diverse patient population that we serve. We have a lot of LGBT employees at our group. We're very a science-driven company, and we're like the only company large company that in our space that didn't have a LGBT alliance group. And you know, and I just thought that was kind of odd. I have a lot of friends in that community, and we decided to, you know, investigate a little bit. Why is this the case? Do we need one? Why is Gilead, why don't we have one? And so we decided, you know, maybe we don't need one because we are inclusive, but there are all these new people coming in. We're expanding. We have people moving here from different places. Maybe they need a home. So we started it out. It was small. And it was so well received. I feel like the investment we made in our group paid exponential dividends. People come to me daily and tell me how what a difference it's made. It makes them feel like they belong at Gilead. I feel in terms of retention, morale, you know, and as well as the normal stuff, the mentorship, the informal mentorship and networking that I see happening. It's just been amazing. And then the election happened, and we randomly had an org meeting the day after the election, and people were so upset. My group was so upset. They were in tears, grown men in tears, and they wanted a message. They wanted a message from our CEO. They wanted something from management to just acknowledge the uncertainty in our employee base. And I found that our group was also a great, you know, support network for each other. And I was able to liaise with the management team to get, you know, something posted. And they were already working on it. But I think the fact that they understood that it was such a big concern to our employees, they sped up the process a little bit. And then people were happy. And it's just being that liaison and to, you know, express the needs of our group was a big deal. And I feel that in today's unstable environment, I think it's even more important. And I feel that companies really should focus on inclusion and diversity. And the companies that have come out publicly and made, you know, political statements, I feel like that's been really awesome and well received.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love our ERGs. I belong to a bunch of them in addition to managing them at my job, which is interesting. But so you touched on a really important topic, which is the experience of people in the workplace. And I think what we may know intuitively for those of us that come from those groups is that we do a lot of being less than our authentic selves a lot of times in the workplace. So, Brian, I'm going to throw this to you because we've had some great conversations about it, but if everyone wants to, there's a couple of concepts that I found as I've done this work. Actually, mostly my white colleagues are like, what are you talking about? And a lot of my colleagues of color are like, yeah, of course I do that all the time. So I think it's really important to talk about a couple of topics, covering and code switching. Like half the people are like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I totally do that all day. But do you want me to take the definitions and then you can talk about it, or do you want to do it?
We'll split. I'll try covering.
Okay.
And then
all
you go code splitting.
You do covering first.
Yeah, because I got
it. All right, cool.
Because I can leverage your
story. I know,
story
you've got all your good notes and everything, so I want to let you talk about it.
All right, these are the, that's what you sent me.
Yeah, I sent them the questions ahead of time.
Yeah.
Just full disclosure.
So covering, so most people will remember covering, especially in the black community, as passing. I mean, it originally started that. So you had sort of the house slave versus the field slave. House slave is usually of lighter color. Eventually that can turn into passing for white, believe it or not. In recent sort of decades, you see the opposite happen, as well as white people trying to pass for black, often associated with identity. What's interesting about covering is that it really starts with not bringing your full self, where passing is difficult because it's tied to your identity. So that can only work for some. Everyone can cover. And to me, that is something I really started to look into. So Kenji Yoshino did work in 2000. I think Irving Gottfried did the early work in the 60s on covering. And how it starts to stand out in the workplace, it's these small little micro inequities or these small components that you'll start to see. If you have a lot of curly hair, you may straighten it to downplay that part of your race. If you're a woman, You may not speak so much about your family, to not associate that with, hey, that could not enable me to do all the hard work. So you'll see that happen as well. For us, or for at least me, what it starts to really put an anchor in the ground is, are you providing an environment, an inclusive environment, where people can really show up? We often talk about this, or Google will say, psychological safety. Big report they did on teens and really coined that term. At Gilead, we talk about vulnerability without consequences. Can you create that type of environment or not? So, I mean, that's the way I pretty much have seen covering them.
Yeah. And I think of code switching as a part of covering. So what you're really doing when you're covering or when you're code switching is that you're changing who you are to conform to the dominant culture. So code switching, we all use different types of languages in different situations, right? So the way that I like talk to my mom on the phone is very different than how I talk to my CEO. I try to use bigger words with my CEO. But code switching is a little something more specific, and it mostly applies to the Black community, although I can tell you that the Latino community in the US, we do this too, which is that we switch from our comfortable dialects, the way that we talk to our friends, to our families, and we switch to sort of standard English, right? In this case, there's actually a name, like African-American Vernacular English is like a whole specific dialect with all these like linguistic rules. It's fascinating, by the way. If you ever fall into that wiki page, I highly recommend it. Yeah, it's really fascinating from a linguistic perspective. But talk a little bit about code switching and why you can't talk, at, like talking Black, basically. You can't do that at work in corporate environments in most places. And kind of that effect, or if that's experience, that happens to me at work. Like the way I talk to my family and my friends is very different. Yeah.
You know, the first thing I'll say about it is that it's exhausting. It can be exhausting.
Yeah.
but you learn, you know. It's one of the things you learn is that this is a complex topic. One of the things you learn is that, do you want to be understood? So there's basic communication.
Yep.
Like, if I say blue and we don't agree what blue is, you're not going to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's great.
So, yeah, exactly, all day. Is it black or gold, right? So either way, like, there's just the baseline non-judgment effect of you have to have a common language in order to communicate with people and get things done, right? So that's one thing that you have to consider. But the other thing is that you also have to get your head around what you're trying to accomplish in your career and what that thing looks like. And this is where it gets complicated, because if you look at the research, and about a year and a half ago, there was some research that looked at all the CEOs. You said there's Ursula left, so there's now zero Black. There used to be Ursula Burns. She's now no longer CEO of IBM. So when you look at all the CEOs, first of all, there's an image. This is how unconscious bias works. We all contribute to it. So when you say CEO, this is what CEO looks like. If you look at that Fortune 500, it's male and it's white. It's probably 6 feet tall. It's probably not bald. It's probably a whole lots of other things. One of the things it's likely not is a brown woman with dreads, with kinky hair that's natural. It's likely not a XYZ. And so one of the things that you're trying to do outside of your cultural or your ethnic or racial identity is you have a thing, to your point of being, you know, intersectionality, you want to be a CEO. And if I want to be a CEO, that's what a CEO looks like. Let me kind of like try and like, let me fit myself into that CEO mode. And until you can get around that in your mind, that a CEO can also look like this, me, whatever it is, it's going to be very difficult for you to believe that what you bring to the table authentically can get you there. And so there's a lot of complexity in that, because none of us are one thing, right? That's what intersectionality is about. I am a woman. I am Black. I am cisgender. I am a mother. I am a corporate executive. I am a thespian. I am from Ohio. God bless me, you know. So all of those things are true. Right? And so as you try and reconcile all of those identities, one of them being Black, a strong one being Black, and having some of the best and worst consequences in my life, because that's what people see, those are the things that you have to reconcile. Am I going to show up with that today? Am I going to show up with that today? And as you go through your career, depending on what you believe that path to be, what you end up doing is trying to replicate whatever the model is for the success that you want to accomplish. Yeah. So.
And I think something you mentioned there about bias is also that one of the biggest problems is you want to communicate, you want to, you know, translate an idea, but also that we have been socialized to think that ideas that are presented in a particular type of English are smarter, are more correct, even though there's absolutely no correlation between the dialect of English and whether the idea is really great. So there are things like that. So it's I think of it as a coping mechanism.
It can be. I don't want to cut you off. I mean, it certainly can be.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you, and this is a result of the changing world. So now that you have a president who was black, now that model is there. So maybe you can look like that. Now that we know Ursula was at IBM, she had a short fro. She wore her fro the entire time she was there. It can look like that. But until some of those images start to kind of proliferate, it's very difficult for that to become the standard. The last part of what I should say, though, is I have two phones I carry. Beth has my phones. And I carry two phones. And one phone is full of, like, what y'all doing? Where y'all at? Why? And I deliberately, because I know if I got that pink phone, I'm going to be acting up. If I got the blue phone, I'm going to be, that's Yahoo's phone. I mean, getting Yahoo, you know. But the truth is, as I, you know, become more, you know, that literally happens all day, right, to a very degree. And occasionally, you know, pink phone language slips on blue phone language. And then people are starting to say to me, so there's cultural appropriation too, right? So people start to use my language because they once they know you, they have the ability to then say, oh, just because it sounds like that, to your point, doesn't mean it's a bad idea. And so I think we have an opportunity to become more of ourselves, to cover less as we get into positions of influence. And allow people to see who we are, because part of the problem is we continue to hide it. The authenticity is a two-street, it's two things, it's a two-way street. One is your ability to be authentically yourself and feel empowered in that, and the other one is to be accepted as that. But you have to decide, it's not only one thing. You can't expect people to accept you as you are if you're never as you are. But on the other side of that, you can't expect people to be as they are if they're going to be penalized or not rewarded.
Right.
So both of those things have to be addressed, yeah. I think.
My only add to that was, and it's spot on, it's how do we create the environments for those to happen? So you typically have a story which is, and we see this a lot as black people in America and black people in corporations, is you may see another black person across campus and you have two choices. Typically, two things may happen. You can give them the nod. I see you.
I give them the nod.
That's going to happen. The other part is you keep your distance. Now, this is an interesting part that tends to happen. You don't want to get too close to other black people because then you may feel, well, I'm associating with black people that I may not know, and do we have a certain reputation? I've heard stories of, well, that person may not be here long, so I don't know if I need to be that close. And that, to me, is also the scary part. That as a community we tend to do. We may keep our distance because, hey, I made it. I don't know this person. And now, you know, my proximity to that person, I get judged. And this is something, as we started the employee resource group at Gilead, we really had hard discussions about, was that we do need to come together. You do need a place where you can slip into easy language. You can talk about different things. And it was a powerful moment to sit in a room like this and see over 200, and that's about the round number at Gilead, about 295 black people all in one room, and thanking everyone and smiling and going, it's about time that we did this. So that was the only thing that I would add is,
sure,
we have a responsibility sometimes to stand tall and create those moments. And I typically try to tell a lot of leaders that is the one thing you have that you need to exercise the most. Create a shared reality. That is part of being a leader. You need to create a shared reality. At the end of your tenure, always say thank you. And then in between, you need to create moments.
You create moments in which people can come together, moments in which voices can be heard. And I said, if you do that, yeah, you can walk away, you know, pretty proud.
Awesome. Well, I have a couple questions on my list, but I know you all probably have awesome questions as well. So if anyone has questions, if you want to jump up to the mic. Yeah? Anyone feeling brave? Cool. Got at least one. We'll just go like off and on. We've got about 15 minutes. So.
Okay, sure. Thank you for sharing your personal stories. Okay. So I'm the lead for Conexion, which is the Latino network at Cisco. Have you heard of it?
I have.
Great, wonderful. So my question is, how do we hold leadership accountable, especially when it comes to hiring?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Over to you, Brian.
So, but the one thing, and I truly enjoy being around a lot of women. So this is a weird thing. And it came out really weird, but it's a weird thing in that my family, I grew up in a very matriarchal family. I mean, my mom has 7 brothers, sisters, mostly women around, all the men who grew up in that family. And if you know about black families, the black female is a very powerful figure. So this reminds me of something that's, you know, my mom would always say, or my wife, don't mansplain something to me. There's a short story. What you start to hear, and it's all over the media, is the Super Bowl. So forgive me for bringing this up, but that's the thing you're going to hear about. It's Super Bowl, Super Bowl, Super Bowl. If you read between the lines, there's one comment or quote you're going to hear a lot, and that's Bill Belichick's quote of, do your job. Do your job. And it's the way in which he talks about certain things. At Gilead, we have a very similar quote that we probably should say more. And we often say, do the right thing. And do the right thing in the right way. It is part of our core values. When you think about hiring, there's often, once again, an NFL rule, which is called the Rooney Rule. Facebook is using the Rooney Rule right now, which is basically you need to put at least one diverse candidate on a slate. We've discussed at Gilead, you need 2 because 1 is not something you want to judge against. If you only have 1 and you cast the, you know, your stone against that 1, you may get a perception that that 1 represents everyone, that 1 Latino. All Latinos must be that way. So we've played with this idea of diverse slates, which is the idea of having 2 or more diverse candidates on each slate. It is a way of addressing the issue. It's not perfect. And I'll give you strong examples of what it's not perfect about. I'm a Latino gay, and I want to be on the slate, Brian. Can I do that? Can you put that person on the slate? No, I want a disabled person on the slate. Make sure that happens. What you start to get in these small conversations of operationalizing the slate, and it can take you down rat holes, because each hiring manager is going to say, well, then how should my slate look? Where should my slate be? What, you know, how long will this take? So we've really tried to ratchet up that conversation and say, let's talk about macro level trends for Gilead. Being able to hire women, that could be a diverse slate. Being able to progress women, doesn't have to just be hiring. We want the slates as promotions go through to have women on them. So there are multiple ways in which you start thinking about, you know, upping the pool when it comes to recruiting and hiring. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, the other thing I would add is there's a lot of a power in accountability with just data, generally. Mm-hmm. So, like, that is an accountability mechanism because you either force people to say, like, no, this isn't a problem and I don't care about it, or not. And I can tell you from experience that when you give those leaders the data, they tend to act. And the reason is because I will tell you that most people are completely delusional about the diversity
That's
of a group
right.
that they're looking at. So research shows that when women are 17% of a group, we think they are 50%. Right, you're like, what? It turns out that the average crowd seen in movies is about 17% women. There's a whole lot of reasons for it. But so giving them that data, it turns out that research says that the average American voter thinks that they're 15% Muslims in the US. They're actually less than 2% of the population. So math is helpful, right? Science, yay. But so that's a big thing. At Atlassian, something that we do is we both do our external sort of diversity reports, but we also report internally on our promo rates. And we don't necessarily give percentages for raises or for promos because that's a little private for folks, but we do show what's the gap in percentages between men and women or between people from majority and minority racial groups. And people can ask those questions, and it means that if there is a problem, the leader then has to answer the question, and it's much easier to answer with, I'm going to fix it, than I don't care. Like, very, very few people actually fall into the I don't care camp. So asking for the data can be powerful.
Yeah. Only, do you have any...
I was just going to say a big driver for accountability is also the public reporting. We have committed at Gilead to reporting our race data every year in our corporate responsibility report. And I know a lot of our companies and peers in Silicon Valley do the same. And you can see it trend for the better. And so that's a way that you know something's working or not working. And I would encourage that.
This is kind of along the same lines. My name's Shannon. I work at a nonprofit biotech in San Francisco, Gladstone, actually, the behind the drug that you're talking about. They did that at Gladstone. So my question is, we formed a new diversity inclusion office with some employee resource groups, and I wanted to know if there's any best practices you have of maybe what not to do when you're starting some of these efforts at your workplace.
You want to start?
Yeah, I have a pretty strong opinion about that. And so, what did you say?
I had to give you the time. It's your turn.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it's like we're dominating the conversation. So I started as the co-chair of the YBN, the Yahoo Black Network, and I was doing it to go once a week and have some fun and use slang. I was like, hey, y'all. That's all I wanted to do. And it started to become the highlight of my week. Because all week I was in a sales environment, I was the only black woman, often the only woman. And it was just, I was just so buttoned up trying to like relate to these people, you know. And one of the things that we put in place, I think Naila's, oh, she is here, she's still here. One of the things we talked a lot about, because I was new to the group, I had been there for about 5 years, at the time maybe 4 years, but they had been doing this much longer. And I was really adamant that the ERGs cannot be the diversity strategy. Your diversity strategy is not go start an ERG. And the ERGs cannot run the diversity strategy. And so we had a situation where it was an unfortunate situation, where someone used some unfortunate language. And it kind of ran through, like somebody got it, and then it got to us and to the YBN. And it was like, oh, what are we going to do? And I was like, do nothing. Do nothing. Let's see what corporate is going to. And I was just like, please do nothing. That was my plea, because I think we have to have, to your point, to your question, corporate level accountability, corporate level response to this, to that thing that was happening. And I still feel strongly about that. Now, having said that, the ERGs are critical to inclusion strategy because they drive retention, they drive, it's a leadership development lab that diverse talent would not otherwise get. They drive cultural awareness and cultural competence. A lot of people in their life have never been exposed to people of color, people from different nationalities. This is that opportunity, and if done responsibly, it can be positive. And the other thing is market advocacy. Right, so one of, you know, our ERGs have more than once said, "Wait a minute, that does not represent the version of this culture that I come from," and so that's important. And what we've tried to do this year, we just had our ERG summit 2 weeks ago. My team's in the room; they did a great job on that. But what we tried to do is start to ask the ERGs to think about how do you amplify the impact on the business? How do you move from being an employee resource group to being a business resource group? And how can you have a positive impact on the business? It's going to mean greater visibility for you that you may not otherwise get. It's going to mean a more enriched environment, cultural competency, and awareness for individuals. Super important, especially if you're in sales. The world is changing. This is undoubtable. So you have to be able to talk. You have to be able to relate and understand and can't be visibly uncomfortable in a room full of people. Like, I've never been around so many at once, to your point. So I think they're important, but they cannot be your diversity strategy.
And then my only add to that, and I know we're going to hopefully get another question, is...
Yep. Or the hook. She got that 5 minutes.
Right. the biggest thing that we're... So in starting inclusion and diversity only about a year ago, our biggest thing was, how do we do it different? And do it in a way that's just totally different. And the idea we came up with is, we will not separate the function. The function will not be cleaved off in its own world reporting out to the CEO. It will be an integrated effort. So right now it sits in what we believe is the biggest mechanism to change behavior, is within your leadership or learning development, an OD type function. So that was our play. It's our bet. It's actually a bet we're making, is if we bring that closer to what you do as an employee every day, then we win. You create an avenue of diversity of thought. So we haven't talked about that, but you provide an avenue which is not just identity, but you start talking about cognitive diversity. You know, different perspectives. How do I operationalize that? This definitely then broadens the conversation and allows you to play with ERGs. It allows you to play with inclusion as a way of encouraging diversity. It gives you a lot more levers to pull.
And we'll do one more here. So, yeah, over on the right.
Hi, my name's Latrice. I run a product operations team at VMware, and I just co-sponsored, or I'm a co-lead now for the Black at VMware ERG group. So this is like hitting the nail on. A question that I have for you is kind of question, but whenever we're talking about diversity, we're talking about fear. And Black at VMware, with some of the recent murders of Black men, we had to do a safe space conversation. And it was kind of eye-opening for me, because I've lived in the Bay Area all of my life, but now we're going globally into Tennessee and Atlanta, and Black in outside of, or I say Black in Atlanta is different from Black Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. Now I'm becoming this face of Black people, and I'm okay. I put that on my shoulder, but now I'm getting calls about some legal issues, some managerial issues, anything under the moon. So while I appreciate that and I can put that on my back, now people feel motivated and they want to come to work, and we're definitely tying the diverse efforts to the business. Mm. Now I'm an ambassador and I have this obligation to make sure that I can now support this team. Any thoughts, guidance, feedback on that?
I mean, I would suggest getting some help. Get cross-functional partners on your team and delegate as much as you can. You can't do it by yourself. And get someone on legal.
My executive sponsor is the chief legal officer, so we're, and she's been great.
So. Do you have an allies group? Have you started an allies group?
We have allies as well. I think the thing is that safe space. You talked about that conversation where people can kind of let their hair down, and we had that safe space conversation about, what does my Black son have to worry about in his private schools compared to other students, you know? I think it's more than that. I think it's more than executives saying they're going to do something, but actually rolling up their sleeves and doing something. So I don't know if you guys, I mean, have that experience or not, but when your top leadership level says one thing but is not putting forth effort to do another, where are you going?
Yeah.
Well, this is what I'll offer. Not a solution, but a perspective. Because the work is hard and complex, and nobody's figured it out. I applaud you guys. I think there are many, many models out there, people trying to get it right. We're trying something different, where I don't want to hear about diversity. I want to talk about inclusion, right? You're starting to hear that, and that's going to belonging. And then somebody's going to come up with another word. So I don't pretend like we figured it out, because we have not figured it out. There's not one thing that's going to make a difference. It's no silver bullet. And the reason why these conversations get mired is because there is fear. There is, like, the sense of mine. You're trying to take what's... I mean, that's what's happening in the country, right? People are afraid they're going to lose what they perceive as theirs. So one of the things that I believe in this effort, the reason why we spent money investing in our ERGs at the summit, is you have to have a ground up, a grassroots, and a top down effort. And it's not only your CEO cannot, they can come from on high and say whatever they want to say. They're not going to change the world. But what you can do for these people who are, what we were able to do is identify, you only need three, right, to start with. Have you ever thought about It's that one curious white dude who's crazy enough to go visit the jails. Have you ever thought about what that reality looks like? Let me just show you. And then next time you do it, bring two or three friends. And then the next time you do it, you should go take two or three friends. If you do it in a way that you're trying to create concentric circles, then all the work will not be on you. You should not take that on. It's the reason why I didn't want the Black Network to say, someone said the N-word, we must revolt. It's our job. It is not our job. And it is not our job. Just like today, everybody's like, what are we going to do about the executive order? Marjane, what are you going to say? And this is controversial because everybody does not agree with me. Mm-hmm. My team does not agree with me. But what are you going to do? And the question is, well, what do you want done? What do you think should happen here? And so what I would encourage you to do is find not only your executive sponsor, they're great for what they're good at. Ours is our general counsel, too. He's awesome. He will go. I've seen him fall on the sword for me and for others. He's great. But you cannot have two or three people carrying the tune. You need to be very strategic in every location. Find one, two people who will have that conversation on your behalf. But you have to take them through the experience so that they know what that feels like. Are you scared when you get stopped by the police? The white dudes are like, why? I just tell them, let me get my license. Like, there's no awareness of that experience. So try and create experiences, get a little bit of empathy going, and then start to slowly recruit your soldiers. That's, again, a perspective.
Yeah, I would say I want to give you a different piece of advice. As someone who used to be an ERG leader, and now, weirdly, I get paid to do that. So I'm an empath. I'm like, oh, let me feel your feelings with you and like help you solve it. And it like that is the worst thing possible in my job. So something that I tell you, and I practice this every day, so I think everyone that works in this space should do it, is recognize that you can solve without empathizing in that moment. And the more that you can create some emotional distance mm-hmm. from solving those problems, the more effective and long-term you will be able to solve them. Because it is emotionally and psychologically and spiritually exhausting mm-hmm. to hear those stories. The way that I do it is if someone comes to me with an issue like you've talked about, I say, thank you. I can tell that this is really heavy on you. I want to help you work through it, and I can't do that if I'm feeling all the details. So let me help you find the person who's going to fix this problem for you. And so I draw that line, and I would just offer that to you, because you seem like you're going to be awesome. But like, find the other person to solve the problem. Be like, if it doesn't get solved, come back and talk to me, and I'll find someone else.
And I wouldn't even, I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
And the one thing that people said to me, oh my God, like Marjane, not this job. Because I'm very tied and, you know, emotional. But I'm a little bit emotional sometimes. But one of the things that I think we all have to get used to saying, there is no, and this is Ta-Nehisi Coates, so I'd love to take credit for it. I didn't come and comfort you. I did not come to tell you it would be okay, because I have never thought it would be okay. And some things are not going to get resolved. Some things I don't have a solution for. So for the executive order, I can reaffirm our commitment to inclusion and diversity. I can tell you that you are here today and we see you in the vision of our future, in our future vision of success. I believe that deeply. I cannot tell you there will not be an executive order that will require action that you don't have to take. And that's really what people want to hear. So I think you have to start to realistically, not to be a downer, but introduce into the conversation what we're trying to do is not, I'm not here to solve that problem. Like, I go through great pains to say, my job is about making this business more viable and relevant for the generations of the future. My job is not necessarily social impact, social justice. It's supported by that. I'm a supporter of that myself. It can help what we're doing, but that is not what I am endeavoring to do through my role in inclusion and diversity. I will help it, but get really clear, really very, very clear on what you're doing. I just got the hook. Damn.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I'll talk to you after. I hope that helps.
Yeah. I think we're all done, but thank you everyone for coming. I'm so sorry for those we didn't get the questions for, but thank you our awesome panelists.